world where all sorts of crazy things happen. And yet, as I hold the bread, sharing communion, I know once more that God is in control and his plans are unstoppable. And yet that's hard to cling on to, isn't it, in today's age? Let's be honest. Bad things happen, and often bad things happen to good people. Life is not fair. And we see that in this passage. It isn't fair for Jesus either, verses 20 and 21. When evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12, and while they were eating, he said, "I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me." Again in verse 23, "The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me." See, it must be hard to experience that kind of betrayal, but so much harder for that to happen with someone that you loved and trusted, a close friend. It's the point of the meal that's going on. We mustn't forget that they were eating a Jewish Passover. They didn't have little bits of bread and little cups like we do. They were sharing a meal together, and each one would have dipped their bread in the same bowl as Jesus. And in their culture, even more than ours, sharing that kind of meal, the Passover meal, was such an intimate thing. It was something done with such good friends, usually family. Even the direct accusation of Jesus in verse 25 is probably not quite as obvious in the original as it's meant to be. It's quite possible that when Jesus said, Judas asked Jesus rather, "Surely not I, Rabbi," Jesus replied something like, "You said it." In other words, Judas was probably the only one who picked up completely the tone of what's going on. It's quite possible that the other disciples didn't really notice it. Jesus is agreeing with Judas, "Yes, it is you," but in a way that might have been ambiguous to the other disciples. Not everyone realized what was going on. But nevertheless, the other disciples did catch enough to realize that this was terrible, shocking news. One of them, one of the inner sanctum, was going to betray Jesus. Although he had done nothing wrong, he was completely innocent, he was going to be betrayed by one of his closest friends. And bad things happen to innocent people sometimes. And when that happens, we feel, don't we, as if the world is spinning out of control. We start to doubt that a good God could allow these things to happen. How can he possibly be in charge? Now we cry out for justice, don't we? And Jesus agrees with us in verse 24. "Woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." In other words, we are responsible. Judas was responsible for his own actions. Judas did a terrible thing, and he received an awful punishment for it. So God will hold each one of us accountable for the things we do. He's going to be completely fair. But notice very carefully what he does say in verse 24. "The Son of Man will go just as it is written." In other words, it's not just that God was able to turn around the mess that Judas was making. Even Judas's actions were part of God's plan. Even in the betrayal of Judas, God is still in control. So, that's not to say, as we thought this morning if you were here, that Judas was sort of like a robot being controlled by that. What we see in this passage again is both that Judas is completely responsible. It's his decision. No one's forcing him to do it. But actually, he is acting in a way that's part of God's plan. And I hope as we view the scene of the Last Supper, we begin to see how this makes communion such a corporate meal. Today, I think it's very easy in our society to turn communion into something that really is just about me and God. But the first communion was not like that. At the first communion, Jesus, I'm now using the words of Paul, but at the first communion, Jesus reminded Judas that he ate and drank judgment on himself because of his actions. As we thought this morning, that's why I sometimes warn people when we share communion that this meal is a meal for Christians only and not for non-Christians. That we should think carefully before taking the bread and the wine, because while ignorance is no excuse, you can sometimes act in a way without really thinking through what you're doing. But here we can see the way that Jesus so tenderly talks to Judas and eats with him and speaks to him, that Judas is actually hardening himself to Jesus in his response, isn't he? See, if Judas acts in this manner, he is making it impossible to do anything except for what he has to do. If I share in communion when I don't really believe what it symbolizes, how can I ever share it properly in the future? Because if eating and drinking doesn't mean anything to me now, why is that ever going to change? And equally, it's a corporate meal in the sense that, again, you think of the disciples, not just the way Judas was treating Jesus, but the others too. That if I have fallen out, if I'm eating this meal and it's supposed to symbolize the fact that I love all my brothers and sisters in Christ, but I know that actually I really harbor resentment against someone or I've got some kind of problem, then I eat the bread and I ignore that, each time I do that, it's going to harden my heart towards that situation. Do you see that? Even after Jesus had said to him, "You have said so," Judas still went on to eat and drink with all the others before going out. And he, even if the other disciples didn't realize, he must have known as Jesus looked him in the eye, "I, Jesus, know exactly what's going on here, Judas." And yet Judas carried on the same. And so, yes, it was a genuine choice, but there's a spiritual dynamic, isn't there, when we share communion. I cannot keep on publicly affirming one thing while privately denying it. I can't keep on doing that time after time without that itself having a spiritual effect on me. So that's why I often say at communion that don't feel embarrassed, don't feel you have to share every time. Sometimes maybe I don't take from the bread and wine because I'm thinking, actually, there's something I need to put right. And communion is supposed to make me think that through, that I don't want to make the mistake that Judas made. Much better to share communion with a clean conscience next time than to risk hardening your heart like Judas. But nevertheless, the main point in seeing all this is communion is yet another reminder that, in a strange way that we'll never fully understand, God, even though we're responsible, God is still completely in charge. And communion reminds us each time in the world in which we live, God's plans are unstoppable. But secondly, we see... Wait, that moves on. Can you click it on, Ewan? Yeah. Secondly, we see, "My sins are forgiven," in verses 26 to 28. See, there's more. Jesus and his disciples, remember, were not celebrating communion. They were celebrating what Jews call the Passover, which was all about being God's people being set free from Egypt as slaves. Everyone was saved who put their trust in the blood of the Passover lamb, the sacrificial lamb. And it was while they were celebrating, Matthew tells us, while they were celebrating the festival of Passover, Jesus gave thanks. No doubt he would have said the common Passover blessing: "Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who brings forth bread from heaven." But then he suddenly adds to that, that they'd be familiar, he suddenly adds, verse 26, "Take and eat, this is my body." Now hold on a minute, if you were there, you'd be thinking, whoa, in effect, Jesus is tampering with the liturgy of the Passover. What's he adding this bit in for? It's a bit like, you know, if you go to a wedding and the vicar's going through all the vows, if the vicar suddenly said, "And, you know, do you promise to put the toilet seat down once, you know, every time you use it? Do you promise only to call your mother once a week?" At that point, everybody's ears are saying, "So wait a minute, he's mucking around with the vows. He's adding some extra stuff in." So equally, the disciples would say, "What is going on? Take and eat. This is my body." Now, clearly, much could be said about that. For the purpose of this evening, we're not going to go into all that's going on there. But let's just see what Matthew puts it there. Here, clearly, Matthew wants us to see Jesus' death as fulfilling the Passover festival. That just as the Israelites were saved from Egypt because they trusted in the sacrifice of the lamb, the angel of death passed over those who had the blood sprinkled on their doorposts. So equally, Jesus is going to be a Passover lamb, and we must trust in him. And more specifically, Jesus does explain what the cup represents in verse 28. "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." So the wine clearly represents Jesus' blood shed for us. Why? For the forgiveness of sins. So as I drink from the cup, isn't it wonderful to think every time you share communion, this is saying confidently, "My sins are forgiven." Isn't that fantastic? As we thought last week from John 13, that Jesus has given us a bath, that our feet are being washed, that we are declared clean and forgiven. So all those who take communion, they are saying to themselves almost, their identity, "My sins are forgiven. I am clean. I'm part of Christ's body." Isn't that great? But thirdly and finally, there's a future aspect to this too. It also teaches us that God's promises are forever. This is new. The bread and the cup speak of a new covenant. You might notice that there's translational arguments on verse 28, whether it should be the blood of the new covenant or the blood of the covenant. We don't know. But either way, from the rest of the New Testament, it's very clear that Jesus is bringing in a new covenant here. It's not just the Passover, there's something new that he's bringing out as well. I remember once listening to a spokesman from Mars trying to tell us about the way, remember when Kit Kats came out and they had that sort of shrink wrap to that? When that came out, there was a spokesman saying, you know, that this was the new way, and this was fresher. He said, by doing this new packaging, it would make new Kit Kats fresher. And of course, the person interviewing him as he gave this great, you know, advertising how great it was, asked the obvious question, which was, "Does that mean that we're eating stale Kit Kats now?" He struggled a bit that. The spokesman tried to disagree, but as soon as you talk about new and improved, you make what you've already got sound obsolete, don't you? And Jesus is doing a similar thing in the new covenant that's promised in Jeremiah 31. It's not saying that this is plan B, that God's plan is new in the sense of we've got rid of, you know, we had part A and now this is part B. This is new in the sense of this is still part of the same plan, but it's better. It's the same promise now, even better. So it's not that God's promises have changed, but they are fulfilled with something more wonderful because these promises are now forever. So we look all the way from Exodus to the cross, we see God keeping his promises. God's promises are forever. We see that in verse 29, because Jesus says to his disciples, "I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." So when we share communion, there's a future sense to it as well, that actually this is a temporary meal, we won't have to have this forever, but it looks forward to the day where we'll be having a wonderful party, a banquet, with Jesus in heaven.